Good evening. This is Life Rattle, the story show. I'm your host, Lori Callis. Tonight, on Life Rattle number 1248, we begin a showcase of Life Rattle classics, the writing of Virginia Ashbery. Virginia Ashbery was born in Toronto in 1952, the youngest of three children. She left home at 17, married on her 19th birthday, and had three children. She left her husband, took the kids when they were 8, 6, and 3 years old, and went to live in Peterborough on mother's allowance, where she went to university. In 1985, Ashbery sold everything she had and drove the three kids across Canada to Victoria, BC. She returned 6 weeks later to face the issues she realized she'd run away from. "Things were difficult until I was 40," Ashbery says. "But now they're better." This year, Virginia Ashbery moved to Hamilton, Ontario. Early every morning, she commutes to Toronto, where she has worked in social services since 1991. Watch for a collection of stories by Ashbery to be published by Life Rattle Press later this year. Virginia Ashbery's voice will sound familiar to Life Rattle listeners. She took over the helm of Life Rattle Radio when co-founder Arnie Achtman died in 2005. Her loyalty, determination, and energy kept Life Rattle on the air. In tonight's show, you'll have the pleasure of listening to her stories. Arnie Achtman said Ashbery writes in direct, accessible language. Her stories show a shrewd observation of human behavior and a fine balance of toughness and tenderness. Ashbery's writing doesn't pull any punches. Her observations, even in these first two stories written from the viewpoint of a child, can cut like a knife. Ashbery's writing always stands out as honest and believable. Tonight's first story is a haunting, extremely unsettling reminder that childhood is a dangerous place to be. Let's listen now as Virginia Ashbery reads her story, Heat, tonight on Life Rattle. Please note, tonight's stories include disturbing situations and language. Parental discretion is advised.
Heat by Virginia Ashbery. In 1957, I am 5 years old. I live south of the highway, north of the train yards, east of the jail farm, and directly across the road from Queen's Court Public School. This is the ragged end of Etobicoke that even the town aldermen think is Mimico. Dandelions, toys, and bikes litter the scruffy front lawns of small, single-story brick bungalows built in the late 30s. Mothers, in floral print dresses, cook, clean, and venture no further than their own doorsteps to yell out three and more names at mealtimes. Fathers come home tired and dirty from the brickworks and the Goodyear factory every evening to hand out punishments tallied up by mums over the day. The best way to keep out of trouble is to stay outside as much as possible. Kids roam the yards, alleys, and empty lots all day without supervision, but we must be home before the streetlights come on. This rule we all obey without question. At 5, I have survived the consequences of stealing coins from my mother's purse, taking a drag off her cigarette, and bringing a garter snake into the house. But I don't even think about staying out after the lights come on. In the schoolyard, boys burn legs off bugs with magnifying glasses, shoot squirrels with BB guns, and cut each other with jackknives. My two older brothers and a couple of the 13 Curry kids have figured out how to use the youngest Curry boy and me as weapons for their entertainment. I sit astride Davy Curry's chest, his body stretched out on the grass of the schoolyard with only his head on the pavement. Holding his ears like handles, I smash his head against the concrete so hard the vibration makes my fingers tingle. Brown, dried grass under my knees itches, so I rest my whole weight on Davy's belly. He doesn't cry. He's not even awake. We are both 5 and about the same size, but Davy never displays the spunk I do. When we play crack the whip, he lets go on purpose, just to get out of the game. I got my shoulder dislocated last summer because I wouldn't let go. The 4 boys who had been cheering us on go suddenly quiet. My brothers grab my arms and pull me off Davy. The other 2, Davy's brothers, stand frozen. Their mouths move, but nothing comes out. Then Rick and John Curry jump forward, snatch up Davy's limp body, 1 on each end, and start running with him toward home. "Is he dead?" my brothers both whisper at the same time. The Curry kids, already halfway across the yard, don't hear. "Oh, shit," moans Steve. "We're going to get shit. Oh, Christ, is he dead? Did he move?" "No. I mean, I don't know. Maybe he moved. Oh, shit," Leslie sobs. I stand there waiting for orders. Steve drops to 1 knee in front of me, holds my chin, and begs and gasps. "You can't fight anymore. Girls aren't supposed to fight. Don't hit Davy anymore, okay?" "Sure," I say, shrugging my shoulders, looking down, and kicking up a little ball of dust. Steve is not convinced, and he looks to Leslie for support, but Leslie has already crossed the street toward home. Davy and I have been fighting all summer. Steve, Leslie, and the Curry kids say the winner will get a prize. I win every time, and I haven't got anything yet, so what do I care if the game stops? After lunch, I take my red wagon out and up the street to call on Donna and Annie. My wagon makes me the boss of scavenging for pop bottles and ditches and garbage cans. When we have at least 2 each, we take them to the yellow brick variety store on Hay Avenue. The owner, Mr. Colucci, in his white shirt and white apron, stands behind a tall wood-framed glass counter and greets us with his hands held behind his back, rocking on his heels. "Good afternoon, ladies," he calls out, and we giggle. The shelves behind the glass hold a treasure trove of candy. As we take turns pointing at each box, Mr. Colucci repeats, "3 black balls, 1 penny, 2 double bubble gums, 1 penny, 2 licorice, 1 penny. He will recite the price of every morsel for each of us in turn until we make our choices and fill our 3 small brown bags. Mr. Colucci likes little girls. When boys come in, he barks and snaps, "Hurry up or get out." Our favorite candies are the bright red marshmallow strawberries, 3 for a penny. We wet them with spit and rub them all over our lips so it looks like we are wearing lipstick. Then Donna, Annie, and I strut around the store's big cement front step, 1 hand on our waists, the other behind our heads, swinging our hips like little movie stars. Davy Curry sits on the edge of the step, scowling at us through 2 big black eyes. I ignore him, and he's gone the next time I look. Too soon the summer ends, and now, because I'm 5, I learn to tie my own shoelaces, start school across the road, and wear dresses every day. Donna, Annie, and I stay together in the morning kindergarten class, and still play and scavenge in the neighborhood every afternoon. Weekends still feel like summer with everyone outside, but it's getting cold and the streetlights come on earlier. One evening in early October, after supper, I go to play with Timmy on Hay Avenue across from the store. His mom works nights and his 11-year-old brother babysits him. We are playing tag in front of his house when the street lights flicker. Our heads snap up in unison at the bulb on its post, high above the grass verge at the front of Timmy's house. We stand, eyes fixed on the light as I move away wordlessly at a quick trot. Jogging west on Hay Avenue, I have to run the length of 20 houses, turn south down a short stretch of Evans Avenue, then left to my house just 3 doors east on Simpson. My eyes fill with tears, but I know I can't cry now. My only chance is to get home fast, slip in the back door, and make like nothing is wrong. Straight ahead, a deep red sunset over the jail farm gets darker every second, while across the road, the yellow glow from a vestibule lights the smiles of a man and woman and the back of their guest as they say their goodbyes. The man steps off the veranda, gets into his two-tone coupe, and pulls out of the drive just as I run by on the other side of the street. As his car turns left at the corner, still 5 houses away, I think how easy it is for grown-ups, how they can do whatever they want, even after dark. Finally, at the corner, I turn left, then stop. The same car that just passed me sits parked on the wrong side of the road, my side. The door is opened, and the interior light reflects in the shallow, still water of the ditch. I think I hear the radio, but the blood in my ears throbs so hard I'm not sure. The man stands over by the hedge that protects Mr. Wilson's vegetable garden. With his back toward me, all I can see are his dark overcoat and hat. I know what he's doing. I've seen my father and brothers pee on trees. They turn their backs, jiggle, wait, and then jiggle again. But that's out in the country, on long trips in the car, down ravines, past the side of highways, not near home, not in Mr. Wilson's garden. Why didn't he do this at the house he just left? He's taking longer than I remember having to wait for Steve or Les, even when they're being stupid. I take 2 steps forward, cough and shuffle dry leaves at my feet so he'll hear me and hurry up, but he doesn't move. I have to get home now. The dark has turned the giant elms across the road black. Light from the car glows stronger now. I can see papers on the dashboard and the steering wheel with its chrome center where the horn is. He knows I'm here, I'm sure. I have to walk past him, but I'm afraid of when he sees me and knows he's been doing this in front of a strange kid. I take a big breath and start walking, not running, eyes forward, arms swinging at my sides like a soldier on parade. Just as I reach within a few feet of him, he spins suddenly. I stop. His pants are wide open, his penis squeezed tight in his fist. The end is a disgusting ball of wet flesh. He shakes it at me and growls, "Wanna chew, wanna chew." I must get home now. I have to show him I'm tough. Staring straight ahead, I march the few steps directly past him. "Bugger off," I snarl when I pass between him and the car. Not changing speed, I reach the corner, turn and head home. I do not look back. 1 minute later, I'm in the living room of my house. My mother is out. My father and brothers give all their attention to hockey night in Canada. Foster Hewitt's whining voice fills the room. Under the cover of the weak blue light from the television, I drop to the carpet, rest my elbows on the floor, hold my head in my hands, and stare at the screen. "Hey, look who's interested in hockey all of a sudden," Steve jeers. I lie there for a long time, burning. I'm sure when I stand up, I will leave a singed outline on the floor. They didn't notice I was out, and I can't tell them any of it. It's my fault. I broke the rule.
That was Virginia Ashbury reading her story, Heat. Our second story tonight is a timeless piece about the family dog, fruit trees in the backyard, and old-fashioned neighborly spitefulness. Let's listen now as Virginia Ashbury reads her story, Chicken Killer.
Chicken Killer by Virginia Ashbury. Johnny Gunn runs into the schoolyard, waving his arms up and down at his sides like he's trying to fly. "Steve! Steve!" he shouts as he gets within earshot of my brother. Then, sliding to a stop, Johnny throws his right hand on Steve's left shoulder, bends over double, his chest heaving with the force of gasps as he gulps enough air to get his message out. "Your mum, she's going nuts. She's screaming at old Lady Garofalo. Come on, quick, the chicken's dead. There's blood all over the place." Standing up again, he spins and runs the length of the schoolyard and back across the road without even looking for cars. I see him disappear down the driveway between our house and his. Steve stands, staring at the spot in the distance where Johnny just was. Then we both watch as a tiny chicken feather drifts down between us, landing gently on the toe of my green running shoe. "Stay here," Steve says, over his shoulder, as he runs toward home as fast as Johnny. I run as fast as I can after them. At the road, I stop and look both ways, then walk across, just like Mum always says I must. The guns in our house sit side by side, separated by the narrow driveway we share. It leads to a backyard surrounded by an old fence with more holes than fence, and a ragged hedge with matching gaps. A long wooden shed that is also shared sits at the very back of the property. It leans to the right but never falls. None of the windows or doors match, and it's painted a green that has faded to the color of canned peas that Mum boils till they're almost mush. To the left of the shed is the Gunn's kitchen garden. It's a mess of posts and pegs, chicken wire, twine, and sacking material supporting hundreds of bean and tomato plants. It looks like a garbage dump and makes me glad we never eat at their house. On the right side of the shed, our side, there used to be a damson plum tree. Last year, in August, Mum caught Mrs. Garofalo up on the ladder picking the small, sweet blue plums off the branches that hung over her property. She was teetering, almost on the top rung of the ladder, pulling the branches as hard toward her as she could, filling a yellow-flowered cloth she had hung like a sling around her neck and under her arm. "What the hell are you doing?" my mother demanded. "Let go of my tree. You can't steal my plums." Mrs. Garofalo hummed a little tuneless song and kept on picking. Mum's head was shaking fast. Her head shakes a little all the time because of a sickness she'd had as a child. It's a quick jerk like she's telling you no, but when she's mad, boy, it's faster and harder, like she can only just hold her head from spinning right around. Mum called the police station. "That damn woman is stealing from me," she yelled into the phone. "I want her arrested. It's my tree, my plums." She was quiet, listening for a bit, and then she just hung up the phone. For a minute, she sat there with tears in her eyes, her head still shaking fast. "Crazy law," she spat. "Are they going to come and arrest old Lady Garofalo, just like on Dragnet? Will she go to jail?" I sing, jumping up and down happily. "No, she will not go to jail. The police say she can have any fruit that hangs over her property. It's my tree on my property. She knows I need those plums for jam." "Well, I'll fix her," Mum said, wiping her eyes with the back of her hand and heading for the door. In the shed, she dug out a ladder and one of my father's saws. Getting right up on her ladder, while the old lady was still picking plums and trying to ignore her, Mum sawed right through the branch she was picking off. It crashed to the ground on Mrs. Garofalo's side. Then Mum just kept sawing till every branch she could reach was gone. Dad wasn't happy about the tree. He liked plum jam. But he told us all to say nothing about it, and we should try to keep Mum and Mrs. Garofalo away from each other. He planted some more bushes at the back of the yard, ones he said would grow fast and spiky. So today, I'm standing in the backyard, looking for my brother and Johnny and the fight, but no one's in sight. Just as I'm about to give up, I notice a small trail of feathers leading to a low hole in the hedge between the Groffalo's place and ours. Then my mother's voice cuts, shrill and strong, from behind the back fence. You bitch, you're insane. No chicken costs more than 50 cents. Crouching low, then crawling, I squeeze through the hole on all fours, getting scratched and muddy. Standing up, I see a wild zigzag of brilliant white chicken feathers, everyone flecked with red. Mum and Mrs. Groffalo are standing, nose to nose, in the center of the yard. Mum has her arms on her hips. Mrs. Groffalo are crossed atop her large, sagging breast. A big red and white chicken lies low and flat and still between them. Mum's head shakes faster than I've ever seen it shake before. Mrs. Groffalo yells at my mother in Italian. I understand only one of her words. Mum knows the word too and screeches, "Don't you dare talk to me like that." Beyond them, up by the side of the house, Steve and Johnny are crouched behind a big, shiny garbage can. Johnny looks like he's going to pee himself. He's laughing so hard. Steve looks scared. A black and white police car pulls into the driveway fast, almost hitting Steve. The boys jump up, and their heads dart back and forth between the cop getting out of the car and the woman with the chicken. "Hi, boys, what's going on here, eh?" he says, hitching up his belt. My dog killed the chicken," Steve stutters. "Yeah, and old lady Garofalo wants $5 for it, or the dog's got to die." "Where is the dog?" the policeman asks, taking one step back towards his car. "I locked her in there," Johnny says, pointing to the gun side of the shed. "Thanks, boys," the policeman nods, then strides through the blood and grass toward the center of the yard. He's taller than my dad and has a red mustache. Feathers stick to his shiny shoes. "Okay," the cop calls out in a cheery voice. "I'll just have you two ladies step apart. A few steps, please." They obey immediately and then start yelling again. "Whoa," the cop calls out. "I think I have the basics already. Your dog," he says, pointing a pencil at my mum, "killed her chicken." The pencil swings to Mrs. Garofalo, then down to the chicken. "And she's a crazy thieving old lady who thinks she can get 10 times what it's worth out of me. Plums, that's what this is all about," Mum yells. "Plums," he says, but then Mrs. Garofalo's voice rings in. "That my baby, that chicken my pet. She dog kill my pet." Mrs. Garofalo's voice quavers like she's going to cry, but she can't hide a smile, and her eyes stay dry. "Pet, you raise half a dozen stinking, cackling chickens every year for Christmas dinner. It's no pet. How dare you lie like this," Mum cries. The policeman tucks his pencil in his upper left pocket, shuffles around in a half circle, surveying the yard, then nods to my mum to follow him to the hedge near me. "Look, lady, I get the point. You're not denying it was your dog that killed the chicken, and I don't for a minute believe it was a pet. But unless you got loads of money to spend on lawyers, well, this lady's going to get her $5 and more out of you." Mum stares at him, then at Mrs. Garofalo, her head shaking wildly. "Are you okay, lady? Did she hit your head or something?" The policeman has just noticed that Mum's head hasn't stopped moving. "No," is all Mum says, looking down at his shoes. "Will you wait a few minutes while I go get the money?" "Sure, that'll be okay. Don't be long," he says. Mum reaches out, grabs my arm, and drags me along with her, out of the yard and down the drive. I didn't think she'd seen me there against the hedge. She says nothing, not a word, as we circle around the end of the block to our house. We go in the front door, through the house, and into the kitchen. Mum finally lets go of my arm, opens the canister marked coffee, and pulls out a $5 bill. "Stay here," Mum demands, then goes out the back door to the shed, comes out a few seconds later, and heads back around the block. I run out of the kitchen door to the backyard, crawl into the hedge again, and lie flat on the muddy ground halfway through. I stay in the hedge as much as I can while still keeping the whole of Mrs. Garofalo's yard in view. Mum storms into the yard, right up to Mrs. Garofalo, reaches into the pocket of her faded blue apron, and pulls out the $5 and the length of thin rope, about 4 feet long. Mrs. Garofalo takes the money with a grin, then notices the rope. "What that for?" she demands. The policeman, who'd retreated to his cruiser, returns to the middle of the yard, and the boys are now bold enough to be right on his heel. Without a word, my mum bends over and ties the rope around the chicken's legs. "What you doing?" Mrs. Garofalo yells. "I'm taking my chicken," Mum says. "No, my pet." "No, my chicken, bought and paid for," Mum demands. "She's right," says the cop. "You've got the money, she gets the chicken." Mum turns, wraps the free end of the cord around her wrist 3 times, and strides off, dragging the chicken, bumping and rolling behind her. I squirm backwards out of the hole in the hedge. Thorns grab at my dress and pull it up over my head, scratching my back raw. I pull free of the barbs just in time to stand up, smooth my dress, and hide behind the stump that was our plum tree as Mum comes down our side yard under the rose trellis and into the backyard. She's headed for the shed again. Lady, our big German shepherd, whines from the gun's side of the shed. "Shut your goddamn mouth, you mutt, or you're next," Mum yells. Lady shuts up. Mum slams the shed door open hard as she pushes through, still dragging the chicken behind her. The door closes quickly, almost catching the chicken's head. The door is still rattling when Mum comes out again with a spade in her free hand. She unwinds the rope from her right wrist and comes over to where I'm standing, half hiding behind the plum tree stump. "Move," she demands. Then, with the last of her fury, she digs a hole as fast and deep as Dad did planting the hedges. Mrs. Gunn has woken up from her afternoon nap and stands outside her kitchen door, patting her hair in place as Johnny dances around her, acting out the whole story. Her right hand drops from her hair to cover her mouth. Mrs. Gunn stays by her door, making no move to come near. When the hole is about 2 feet deep, Mum grabs up the rope and hangs the chicken high in the air. Spinning wildly at the end of the rope, its head shakes and its wings flop out, but the eyes are limp. Plop, it hits the bottom of the hole, and the rope spills over its body. Mum quickly fills it in and smacks the dirt 5 times with the back of the spade. Mum tosses the spade aside and wipes her dirty hand across her forehead, leaving a wide brown streak. "I'm going to go lie down for a while," Mum says, and goes into the house. Steve reappears from the gun side of the shed with Lady on a leash. He and Johnny take her over to Kenny Marshall's house, where she will stay for 3 days. Later that night, after dinner, after sunset, and after Mum has gone downstairs to do some ironing, I find Dad standing in the dark kitchen, staring out the window to the backyard. As my eyes adjust to the twilight outside, I see Mrs. Gunn in the shadow of the shed, lifting the chicken out of the hole, then filling it back in. "Dad," I say. "Shh," he says. "Those guns will eat anything."
That was Virginia Ashbury reading her story, Chicken Killer. That concludes Life Rattle number 1248. My name is Lori Callis. Arnie Ackman recorded Virginia reading her story, Heat. I recorded Virginia reading her story, Chicken Killer. Life Rattle was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Ackman. Tune in to Life Rattle next Thursday for part 2 of our showcase of the writing of Virginia Ashbury.